FW presents Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today is making his Fire and Water debut, but his podcasting debut. Welcome, Ward Hill Terry.
Thank you very much, Siskoid. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're a listener of the show.
I'm a listener and a lurker.
A lurker
on the site.
Well, you don't lurk very well because you leave quite a few comments, and so we recognize your name.
You know, that is something I consciously made an effort to do, and it was so much fun when I started listening to these podcasts on Fire and Water, and then started reading all the comments and seeing the interaction. And as Shag keeps saying, the community we're trying to build here, that I making an effort to actually, you know, comment, and especially when you respond so quickly and get new programs up right away.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people just, came in through the Who's Who podcast. So there's a lot of comments there, and everybody's got an opinion on their favorite characters. And, I mean, Shag's community is basically, wherever he goes, because he travels a lot, he wants to meet all these people. He needs to build a community because he needs friends in every city.
He's trying to get a free drink everywhere he goes.
Well, actually, you know what? He's
I can admire that.
Yeah, he's pretty generous because we met recently and in person, and he picked up the tab. So,
well, that's very nice.
Thank you, Shag. But you're a listener. I always say at the end of the show, if anybody wants to do one of these, just let me know. And so you let me know. You've decided to put yourself through this.
Well, partly because, like I said, I find this all very fascinating, and I certainly don't have the energy and patience and time to start a podcast, but certainly one can comment on a panel.
Start small.
Yeah.
You start with this, and next thing you know, you're, you know, talking about Shag. Shag's asking you in 3 years, are you available to talk about this Justice League Europe issue? It's kind of like that. Okay, so let's get us a panel.
All right.
Let's use our randomized series of choices using my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital. Prior to the recording, we did roll up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally, a panel. And in this case, we rolled the year 1966, the month of February. Among all the comics out that month, the revolving finger falls on House of Mystery number 158. We're deep in the Silver Age here. Page 16 of 25, which means it will be the Dial H for Hero story, as opposed to the Martian Manhunter story. It's written by Dave Wood, with art by Jim Mooney. It's going to be of the five panels, panel three, which you'll find in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So, Terry, this is a panel from a Dial H for Hero story. I don't know if it shows.
It doesn't.
It doesn't. Okay.
We don't see the dial.
No, you don't. You don't, because the people are already dialed up.
Robbie Reed always transforms into a different character, and you can't recognize him when he's transformed.
That's right. Do you have, you're talking about Robbie Reed as if you know him personally. Do you have a history with Dial H?
I have only a scholar's history with Dial H. I have never read any of the original stories. I did not read the first revival, and I do not know of any subsequent revivals, but I know of it.
Okay.
And there had been a blog I followed for many years that was called Dial B for Blog.
Right.
And the creator of that blog went by the name Robbie Reed and used the images from the original comics.
Yeah. And that was a very specific, you know, looking blog. It had, you know, he did like art pieces for it. So it was a lot more. That wasn't just text. It was, you know, it looked like.
Oh, no, that was a very involved thing.
Yeah, yeah. One of the great ones when I started out. I am a Dial H fan. That's, I've read every story, even every little bit, and I've talked about it on my blog. So, this is the thing.
So Robbie Reed and Chris and
Chris and Vicky and, you know, the adventures they had separately afterwards, and then the Dial H series of sort of kept changing hands in the series in the 2000s. So I just haven't read the Dial H stories that are coming out now. I'm kind of late on those.
Well, good on them for keeping the concept going. Now, Cisco, did you ever contribute an idea to Dial H?
I did. I don't remember what I could. Well, it contributed. Let's understand each other. I've sent in a concept, I think. It was not picked up. It was not picked up. But I've talked because the thing I did on my blog was basically look at every invented superhero and every invented villain as well in the series that used reader concepts and discuss how they might actually be integrated into the DCU if they'd been real characters, you know, more than just one-shot characters. That put me in contact with a lot of people who actually got their concepts published.
Wow.
So this is something that I would like to do at some point, is perhaps reach out to them, because they just left comments on a, you know, on the blog, and reach out to them and maybe organize little interviews and see how, because from what I've read of what they've told me is sometimes they really played fast and loose with your concept. So sure. You sent in something, you might even have sent in just a description without a picture, or there is a picture, but you know, and then they would shape it to their needs. So they might change a lot of things. Sometimes it's like, well, I send in a hero and they made him a villain. Stuff like that. It would be interesting to hear from those people and what they remember actually submitting, as opposed to what came out in the page, and if they were happy with the art, or if it's, oh no, it's like this crappy, I don't know, you know?
Well, that's it. It'd be a lot of them, but you know, but it may have submitted them as pre-adolescents or even adolescents.
Right. Exactly.
Much, much older by now.
Yeah. Although some of them, you can tell, some of them are actually people that went into the business. So there's a few concepts were created by Stefan DiStefano, who became a professional. So, you know, some people, sometimes you say, oh, well, they needed something and they just asked. You know, it's like, I think I caught one once where the submitter was like, I don't know, the writer's wife or something. Yeah. You know, so there's, you know, we need something quick. And it just becomes a reader submission, but really the reader is someone known to the writer or artist. So that happened.
You need content quick. Give me a name. Give me an idea. Give me a concept.
Right. And we'll credit you with
give you credit.
Yeah. Probably with your maiden name or something. So.
Right.
There's a history there. I mean, that was a weird concept, at least the Chris and Vicky years. In Robbie Reed, they're inventing them wholesale themselves.
Yeah.
So that's a different game. And that's how they did it later as well. But the Chris and Vicky years are the most special, because you're basically finding opportunities for, you know, for reader suggestions. I think the interactivity of that is super interesting.
There's back in the day, you had to put a stamp on an envelope and mail it all the way to New York City to get your ideas used.
I know I sent one in, because one of my New Adventures of Superboy has the coupon cut out of it.
Aha.
That's how I know. So I damaged my comics. And all I got was this lousy t-shirt. No, actually, that's what they sent you. If they use your submission, you got a Dial H t-shirt. I'd love to see one of those. So I didn't even get a lousy t-shirt. I got nothing, because they didn't use my suggestion.
Yeah, you're out of the United States, man. They're going to send up to Canada.
There are plenty of superheroes that came out of Canada and the UK. So they had readers from all over the world and used them. But some people just got like a little cameo of their character. It's like, and then Chris and Vicky became these 16 characters in succession.
Oh.
So, oh, God, for people, you know, it's you know what happened? I think my suggestion was sent in and then the series promptly stopped.
So you didn't even make a montage.
No. So I think I sent it in and it was like, it's too late. There's no more Dial H by the time you receive it. So like I tell, I don't even know what I did send in, what I would have sent in. I have some ideas, but I don't have any record or memory of it. Well, let's talk about this specific panel from Dial H history. Do you want to describe it or should I?
I'd like to try at describing this panel.
Go ahead.
Now we're looking at a panel, which I think is a perfect example of a standard adventure story superheroes kind of comic book panel. This is how a comic book panel should look. There's at the very top of the panel is a caption box reading "An Instant Later." Immediately below that is a dialogue balloon coming from what looks to be the villain of the piece, because he is standing, arms on hips, or at least the visible hand. One hand is off panel. In a glowing, satanic, hellish red-looking armor type of outfit with an evil grin on his face. Immediately below the first word balloon is a second word balloon of what looks to be the hero, because he's in a blue outfit, coming in from the right side of the panel, directly at the antagonist, and he's speaking calmly and looking very powerful. At the same time, there's some sort of a firework effect coming off of the bad guy, in all directions, with three, count them, three sound effects, whiz, wee, and boom, all lettered in very uneven lettering, giving the illusion of movement and impact. So these are big yellow bursts coming off this glowing red body with a black background. And the other cool thing about this panel is that it is not perpendicular on all sides. The left side in top and bottom make 45 degree angles, but the right panel cuts in from the top going toward the left and the bottom. So it's at an angle, which I like because it, on the one hand, it focuses. This is something I like to talk about when I analyze comic books, where the eye has to go. So the word balloons lead the eye to where the characters are. The action sort of completes a circle. The villain is standing solidly in the lower left, and the hero is coming from the right toward the left. And the panel border is also sliding down toward the left. So the eye keeps coming back to the villain. Also, since you said this is panel three, I am presuming it is not the last panel of the tier, but there might be one more panel. So the eye is also being led back upward to go to the next panel on the right.
You're right. This panel is on the left side of the page. There's another angular panel that follows it.
Yeah. So there's a panel immediately to the right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is also angled to fit there. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're completely right about the composition here. Everything seems to lead you back to the villain. You're right. Is the villain in the dialogue boxes? The hero calls him Daffy, and you'd think, well, that's just like a nickname, you know, like an insult name. But
yeah.
No, that is actually the name of the villain. Daffy the Great. So the context that we don't have here is basically this was a story called Dial V for Villain. It's one of those where somebody dials the wrong thing on the dial. So
he dialed it backward?
The dial that Robbie had a lot of symbols on it. It wasn't just H-E-R-O. So you could spell many things.
That.
Yeah, I think there's one where they spell monster, you know, stuff like that. So in this story, this guy called Daffy spins the dial, dials villain, I guess, becomes a villain. And the villain is this monster, this red. He's got like these crazy squid-like fingers. He's got, it's not even a costume. This is his body. He's like the thing or something, but red. And I like the effect here because like the plates, that it's like chitinous armor. The plates are in the black range, and then all the seams are in red, and not there isn't always a line to close that off. So it seems like it really does seem like he's glowing, like he's made of lava or something.
Yeah, it's a fantastic effect.
Yeah, I love it. And especially since it really pops because he's surrounded in this glow, which is his power, it's a sort of aura.
Yep.
Some sort of force field, and whatever the hero is throwing at him is bouncing off as fireworks. So the black background, the fireworks flying, and this looks like an effect where in the inking or in the drawing of it, it was all black and then, I don't know, like white paint to do the effect, to do all those dots.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's a really unusual kind of effect, and everything really pops and comes back to him because though the fireworks are flying away from him, you get the sense of their arrows pointing at him. That's how your eye works, right? And in this the small context that I can give, Robbie has turned into a hero called the Squid that looks nothing like a squid. But
I never would have guessed.
No,
the Squid.
There is a chest emblem that is vaguely Hydra-like. That we don't see here because he's lying forward on some sort of crazy carpet, flying crazy carpet.
Or like a toboggan, because it's curled up in the front.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, the powers are that he has this sort of helmet, right? And the helmet spritz out different liquids. I guess that's what's the squid ink, I guess. And these liquids can become things or weapons. Or so, like, in the previous panel, he used the liquid to create the toboggan, mm-hmm. that sled. And now he's apparently shooting some of those liquids at Daffy. Because the dialogue that we didn't read the dialogue. The dialogue is,
ha ha ha, some super solution. My glow transformed your liquid's power into a harmless fireworks display.
Okay, so that didn't work. I hate to do this, Daffy, but it's the only sure way to stop you.
And then I guess there's another move, you know, does a power move after this that we don't see.
Well, that's the other thing I like about this panel, why I think it's such a great example of mid-century Silver Age heroic panel. The confidence of the hero's voice, his demeanor. Mooney does a lot with this tiny, tiny drawing. You can see he's got muscular shoulders. He's got a determined chin. He's not straining about this. He doesn't mind wearing this bizarre helmet, and it looks like it's attached to some sort of mechanism on his back. So even the colorist is taking care to put make sure the right touches are there.
Yeah, there's probably tanks of liquid or something that's that he draws from, you know. This is unusual as well because, you know, back in the day, very often there's no letterer that is credited. And that's because usually maybe the artist did it. I think you can sort of tell sometimes that such and such an artist, such and such a lettering style. So
yeah,
I think that's the case here. And it's like, it's not like the bubbles that we've been used to, the round bubbles.
No, and this is the thing that I find really hard to read in mid-60s DC comics, especially books like the Doom Patrol. The lettering is, the word balloons are lumpy.
Right.
It's not one smooth line with the tail. This Daffy's word balloon has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 separate scallops, not including the tail. So there's really, it's this lumpy balloon. And I always found that annoying.
Yeah, it does feel like they did the writing and then they drew the balloon or the really a cloud, the cloud all around it to sort of make it fit the exact, you know, shape of the sentences. So that's not as slick as round bubbles, that's for sure.
No.
How did you resist making pee jokes with the sound effects here? Because whiz, and then we, and then boom would be a number two maybe, but the it does seem like, to the juvenile mind, which I seem to be able to tap into, especially with the, you know, all the yellow kind of springing from Daffy's figure, I question whether or not there's like a smile behind it.
Oh, perhaps. I generally don't think that way in my onomatopoeia. I'm hearing fireworks when I read these.
Good. You're a more mature man than I. these are not the best dial-ups of the series. You know, Daffy the Great or the Squid. They are not the greatest characters ever put on the page in House of Mystery.
They sound like editors, not creators, who chose these names.
And, well, that's a question. It's not readers' suggestions here. It's, you know, artists and writers having to come up with these concepts. They're all throwaway concepts. You can't use them again. So when you're talking about throwaway characters like this, what would be your approach? Are they like sabotaging them? I mean, you don't want to create Wolverine by accident.
Even though this is the days way before rights and royalties for creators and creations. But yeah, the idea of nothing permanent. So why bust yourself coming up with this great idea? Although back then the books they were putting out, they still had to come up with a villain of the month. I think if you were lucky, you came up on, oh, this one might be good to come back again. But think of all the stories, and just out of DC, who was the editor of House of Mystery back then? Was that Jack Schiff? Frankly, one of the lower tier editors. He wasn't Schwartz. He wasn't Weisinger. And none of those books ever seem to be playing the long game. We need a story this month. There's no real sense of any kind of continuity. And admittedly, I haven't read these stories, but I know. Does Robbie Reed have a supporting cast?
He's got a girlfriend that comes up and that she dials once. She's referred to several times. And I think he's got like a
mom?
Some sort of parent figure.
Yeah. So just get this kid into a costume and get him something to fight.
Yeah.
And give me 12 pages by Thursday.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So, I guess you're right. The villain of the month thing is true. They've created a lot of Morts over the years, especially in the Silver Age. And so this is no different. I think, you know, Daffy the Great isn't that great a name, but the look of him, if he'd been appearing, if he showed up in a Superman comic, then you'd think, well, you know, let's say he's not called Daffy, he could come back.
He'd be called Renktor or something.
Something.
Or, you know, in the last 20 years, they just put various apostrophes in his name.
Yeah, he'd be like an alien or something.
Yeah.
But you could return a character that looks cool, that has maybe a cool backstory. But in Dial H, the backstories are very, very slim. And then it lives in a world where the hero doesn't have any recurring villains because he isn't a recurring hero himself.
Yeah.
So that, over the years, that was always a problem for the Dial H series. You just couldn't really bring back a character. So like Chris and Vicky did have the Master, who was like manipulating things from behind the scenes, and he was creating supervillains much like they were creating themselves as superheroes. So it fit the concept, yeah.
But in Chris and Vicky's stories, already the time, just 15 years, almost, not even 20 years later, the marketplace was different. and comics are already starting, because this is when I was still collecting, was aiming toward the comic collector and the regular reader. The original House of Mystery stories are aimed toward any kid with 12 cents. And any kid with 12 cents who could read, even a kid who can't read, but could pick it up and look at it and understand it. And then not have to worry about, oh man, I missed the last issue. Where am I going to get next issue? No, you read, it's a 12-page story or something, and there you go. It's very satisfying. And that's probably deliberately the market they were aiming at, just the casual reader.
I'll go to bat for my kid self, because I was a teenager, preteen, when the Chris and Vicky stories were published. And I did pick that up. You know, I was that kid with, here in Canada with tax, it was like 83 cents for a comic. Mm. So I always made sure I had 83 cents in my pockets after buying lunch at school. And then we go into town and I would buy a random comic, essentially, because I had the 83 cents. No more, no less. You know,
nice.
You know, I can't get this annual. It's $1.25. Oh no.
Yeah.
During the early 80s, I was totally that kid who bought comics just based on the cover or something, you know. I was buying comics for the same reason that kids were buying comics in 1966, I guess. It just cost a little more.
Yeah, it's funny, thinking of my interest in comics. When I started reading, I started reading the Archies and Richie Riches and other Harveys.
Sure.
But when I started buying and collecting, it was superheroes. That was always my first interest. And I quickly got into the idea of the universe of that hero, the friends and the villains, and oh my goodness, you know, the footnotes, because this thing happened in such and such an issue many years ago, so what a surprise it's come back. This was 10 years after this particular House of Mystery was published, when I started reading. So I would have looked at something like this as being too crude for my tastes. And for a long time, I had that dismissive attitude, even after I moved on from superheroes and just started enjoying other works because I liked the medium. But now, in my adult years, I can really appreciate a book like this much, much more. In other books like this, because I can see the fun in it. Because one of the things that makes me so down on modern comics, by modern, I mean the last 35 years, how serious everything has to be, and how earnest all the characters have to be. And this isn't. This is a lot of fun, and very well done.
I share that history, because I learned how to read in English from Richie Rich and Archie, and none of those comics took themselves seriously. You know, and I got into the comics from the Euro comics side of things, from French comics, you know, Tintin, Asterix, stuff like that. And many of those were heavy on the humor and did not take themselves seriously. So to me, it's always been, although I read those earnest, serious comics, when they came out, especially now, if I pick up a comic, it's going to be one of those ones that doesn't take itself seriously. It's going to be Squirrel Girl and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, Scooby-Doo would team up.
Sure. But yeah, well, I've got a show devoted to team up, so.
Oh, I know.
I have an invested interest in the success of Scooby-Doo team up. But those are the kind of stories that I still enjoy today. So when modern writers and artists work on comics that are fun in that way, that are tapping into that vibe, that's what makes me happy. Whereas a lot of comics are, you know, it's not just earnest, it's deadly earnest. It's got to be about dismemberment and whatever. So that's less interesting. And I do realize that the last episode of this had blood being shed as a moment. But
allegedly.
Yeah, it could be anything. Exactly. So we'll talk about that in the feedback section. If we're done, I'll thank you, Ward Hill Terry, and let you go back to the margins while we listen to a promo, and I'll come back with listener feedback on our previous episode. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you very much, Discord. I really appreciate it.
So which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man. I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Who's he?
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
This is Comment by Comment. We're talking about our previous episode, Panel by Panel, Something Got Your Goat, recorded in balmy St. Andrews-by-the-Sea with Shag Matthews, Shotgun Godin, and Bas Levesque, focusing on a panel from The Invisibles, Volume 3, Issue 8. Let's start with Chris Franklin. He says, well, this was disturbing. Not the panel, but Shag in Canada. I apologize for all of the USA. Seriously, the panel is disturbing, and that curved blade is usually called a scythe or a sickle. I want a new podcast radio drama called Siskoid's Paranormal Investigations. They are each about 2 minutes long and consist of an intro and Siskoid walking into a house and saying, this place isn't haunted. Cut to end credits. I'll keep it under advisement, Chris. Martin Gray says, fun episode as ever. That goat panel is so sad. No kidding. The link with the last episode is that it wound up in a Caribbean curry in Ben Grimm's fridge. I guess going back in time to do so. He says, hey, I was in Canada, but met no one. I'm in Canada again next September. I demand a repeat. And I've talked to Martin since, and we might make it happen, because his boat sort of docks in Charlottetown and Halifax, and those are places we like to go to. So if the dates are right, maybe myself and some of the girls might just skip to the other provinces. Gene Hendricks says, I'm sorry to be that guy, but I object to the notion that if animal sacrifice is involved, then it's evil. Animal sacrifice is part of all heathen high holy days, but the vast majority are votive or representational. All the ones that I have attended have had a cake baked in the shape of a pig sacrificed. There are a couple of reasons for this. One, whatever sacrifice that is to be used has to be raised in luxury, doted, and never wanting for anything. And two, the sacrifice must be killed quickly and without undue suffering, so the person doing it has to be skilled. All of this is because a sacrifice is to take the messages from the assembled worshippers to the gods, and you don't want a bitter messenger. The meat from said sacrifice would then be cooked and eaten by the worshippers, with any leftovers being burned as an offering to the gods. Since I was never involved with any farmers, I've never attended a ritual where an actual animal was sacrificed, but I still see it as community building and overall good. There are evil and torturous sacrifices, to be sure, but please don't make the assumption that all animal sacrifice is evil. Now, can someone help me down from my high horse? Martin Gray there responds, depends if you plan to sacrifice it. To which Gene responds, if it had me on its back, it would certainly not have been well treated so the horse can live. Okay, so let's say this. Panel by panel is for entertainment purposes only. And in that story with the so-called animal sacrifice, the burned feather, I very much doubt that our 19-year-old selves were doing anything but playing and, you know, talking through our asses. Likewise, there's no way the feather caused any problems in anyone's life afterwards, despite what I said. We did it all to ourselves. Now, I know that Gene is actually talking about the sacrifice of a goat in the issue, and that someone said, therefore, whoever's doing it must be evil. And it is The Invisibles, even without looking. I know it wasn't a book about good and evil, really. It was more like order versus chaos, or old cycle versus new cycle. So that was probably the point of the sacrifice in the issue. When you play without context, assumptions are made. There's actually more to this conversation. It's at fireandwaterpodcast.com if you want to chime in under that particular episode. Eric says, another entertaining episode. Just wanted to ask a quick question about what may or may not constitute a single panel. What happens if the randomizer pulls up a page and panel where a word balloon or caption overlaps two panels? Do you count both frames as a single panel, or do you cut off the captions in mid-word and let the guests try to figure out what the rest of it says? Or will you leave the caption balloon intact, but just block out the image of the extra panel? I think probably the last one, Eric. It hasn't happened yet, but all good options, basically. There's no right way to do it, although I don't think I'd show two panels and justify it by saying the caption box, you know, stretched to both. Jack Bond tries to play the game of matching the previous episode's image, the thing looking inside a fridge, and this panel, which was, you know, a goat in front of a brick wall having its throat cut. He says, I see the red, orange, brown, rocky texture, and somebody or some things meet as links between images. But what sticks out to me is the off-panel speaker. In the thing panel, we can't put any names to a face, but it's not a mystery. The invisibles panel, we don't know if Edith, the other she, or the speaker are or were present at this event. And I expect we'll need the words and pictures of several panels to piece together the context. So if people want to play this game, you still can. Is there a connection between the goat panel and the panel that we looked at in this episode from Dial H for Hero. And we'll end on a comment from Ward Hill Terry himself, who was just our guest. He says, this reminds me of the famous Senate, U.S. Senate investigation of comic books. William Gaines, publisher of EC Comics, was asked if a particular cover was in good taste. It was the cover of Crime Suspense Stories. It shows a person from the chest down holding a stained axe in the right hand. In the left hand, the head of a blonde woman by the hair. Beneath the axe, in the background, the legs of a person lying on the floor are visible. Now, Gaines did not acquit himself well with his rambling answer. I have long imagined a better answer, he says. Senator, do you imagine that the head being held belongs to the body on the floor? There is nothing in the drawing that indicates that. Why would you think that the head is not still attached to its body? Is that how you think? The axe is covered in something black and drippy. What makes you think that it's blood? You are drawing these ideas through inference. The Invisibles panel is similar. A black crescent is not positively a blade. An expanding flow of reddish orange cannot be blood. The origin of the flow may or may not be the throat of the goat. The drawing doesn't definitively show it. It's up to the reader to infer the meaning. So it was fun here to have Ward Hill Terry actually on the show to look at a panel in this way, where we must infer things, where the single panel is not the whole story, but several stories seem to spring out of it. Schrodinger's panel, so to speak. And that's the end. As ever, a reminder that if you'd like to do one of these short podcasts, just like Terry just did, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You will be handed a comic book panel randomly and we'll put it up for discussion. My thanks again to Ward Hill Terry, my guest, and until we refill that seat, the panel is open.